Okay. Okay, so thank you very much for the invitation. I think for both of us, because in my I have to say that enjoyed it very much here. First time since 1990 or so, 1980, that we are here. Okay, so I'd like to talk. Okay, this, wow, first. To talk a little bit more material oriented about a very specific compound, namely sodium monodate. And so you see I've moved location with an old transparency, well, not so old, but. I will try to give you a flavor why that is an interesting compound and why I think more work will be done or will appear in this monodates at all. Anyhow, this is an example of a series of compounds. And I will mainly discuss two questions, but I will discuss also other results and new interesting issues here. Two questions are why is that an insulator? Well, if you call it formal valency, so 2 minus, 1 plus, then the vanadium should be mixed valence, but actually it's an insulator, so that was a little bit disturbing, and we did a band structure calculation for that, so I will deal on that a little bit and see what the experts here say. And so we find that it's actually a ladder compound with one electron per rung, so we think it's the first quarter-filled ladder compound which one knows. Then I will discuss a work which was there and I did last year. The question whether one can interpret the measured magnetic dispersion below a transition temperature. I will talk, will of course give an introduction what kind of transition that is, and in terms of the charge ordering which occurs in this material. And we proposed that this should be a kind of zigzag charge outline. So we start with an overview. So the vanadates, there are many, many different vanadates, of course, has rich chemistry. For example, there's this class of compounds, calcium, VN, O2N plus 1, which have very different properties. For the, I will discuss this kind of series, that is a spin ladder compound. And but then there's, for example, if you take N equals 4, you get calcium B4O9, that is a depleted square lattice compound, which has also been studied intensively. So my focus will be on sodium monodate, and actually, as already indicated here, there's a series of isostructural compounds, V2O5, lithium sodium monodate, magnesium calcium monodate, and of course, V2O5, it's just a 3D configuration, the oxygen band's full, it's just a band insulator. On the other hand, magnesium or calcium monodate has a vanadium 3D configuration, so it's spin 1/2, and one finds it's a kind of ladder compound, so just a spin ladder compound or half a ladder compound. And lithium or sodium monodate, on the other hand, is a mixed valence, and you find then that it's probably a quarter of a ladder compound, but nevertheless, they are insulators. But just to put it here into perspective, before I start with the physical properties, here, serious view of the crystal structure of this compound. So there's predominantly 2D, so they are kind of planes of oxygens and vanadiums. Actually, all vanadiums are equivalent. I just draw it here slightly different to point out there's actually vanadiums which are slightly above the plane and vanadium slightly below the planes, but they're equivalent crystallographically. And as one sees also, there's a pretty little symmetry. For example, these vanadiums are not in one line with the oxygens. These are the O2 called, and these are the O1 oxygens. And then there are also the O3 for the apical pyramide, and that is above the planes. And also here, as you see, it's not really in the center of the pyramid, it's very low symmetry at the vanadium side. Actually, there's only one reflection symmetry at the vanadium side. And then the sodiums are in between the planes, and they really just give just charge. And so since the symmetry is so low, it's pretty difficult just to do a classification of the crystal field analysis and say for symmetry reason we have this kind of splitting of the 5d orbitals into what EG or T2g, and the lowest one will be that and that. One has to do a band structure calculation to find that out, or to be clever, like Peter Horsch was. So we were not so clever, so we did a band structure calculation, and I will present the results.
Why do you say Peter Horsch didn't do a band calculation?
No, he just guessed more or less that it was a
vehicle.
Yeah.
All the Jepsen was doing the calculation.
Okay, he had...
He was in band.
Okay, fine.
We were mailing with him at the time we were starting to look at this, and I know he's objection to the calculation.
Oh. Okay, fine. Okay. Okay, now the history of the physical properties of this compound that was first synthesized 30 years ago by two chemistries. A group in Toulouse, I think.
So this is gas,
optical
gas, or giving gas.
Sorry?
Direct
gap, optical, yeah.
No mention about indirect gap?
I don't know. In the band structure calculation, it's direct, yeah. So it's about maybe 0.6, 0.7 electron volt. And so they thought, well, that's pretty strange that this is an, I guess that was what I was thinking. That it's an insulator, so they proposed this charge dissipation, and they proposed a non-centric crystallographic structure. And so everybody was thinking, oh, there's probably spin 1 vanadium and empty vanadium sides. And so when the group in Tokyo, which do the systematic re-evaluation of interesting compounds, re-evaluated our sodium vanadate some 3 years ago, well, they measured the susceptibility and found it's more or less like a one-dimensional Heisenberg model, pretty close actually. So it's pretty good 1D. They find that it has a phase transition at 34 Kelvin, and then gap for spin excitation opens below that phase transition, measured by Fuji et al. 2 years ago. And also they measured the unit cell increases by factor of 2 in A and B direction, by factor of C in C direction. So that's the crystallographic phase transition.
It happens at 34 Kelvin.
And so that all looked like spin pi. So we're saying, oh, that's the second known spin pi compound after copper copper germinate. And so that was up to maybe last year, the standard picture. But this is, we have changed of vanadium plus 5. So what they were thinking in this old asymmetric structure, that these vanadiums are plus 5 and these plus 4, plus 5, and so on. So we think you have a one-dimensional compound with just normal spins like you have that in the cuprates. Well, in some of the cuprates, not the high-DC cuprates. Okay, just to give you a flavor of the experimental data, for example, the susceptibility here below that temperature drops exponentially. That's an indication there are no spin carriers anymore. The Raman scattering is still pretty not understood. We are working on that with part of the spectrum, namely here's two little peaks we're working with. Wolfgang Brennig on this issue. And so one has in the high temperature phase plenty phonons. In the low temperature phase one has additional magnetic bound state or whatever they are, and a kind of continuum here also not understood, and this continuum here is also not understood. It's in the high temperature phase, etc., etc. There's plenty of going on which is not understood. So everybody who wants to work on the Raman data, I think, we'll get an enthusiastic reading from the experimentalist response. So, as I said, the motivation that sodium vanadate is a spin pi's compound came from these two experiments. X-ray intensity of this new Bragg reflection increases exactly here, like a second order phase transition at the transition, and the spin gap measured here, that looks also like in copper germanate, only the energy scale is about four times higher. In copper germanate, it's 2.5 millielectron volts energy. So people were thinking, well, that's actually spin piles, but actually to prove that it's spin piles, one needs this phase diagram, because this phase diagram is Jan Affleck was mentioning, he was discussing this transition, that in a magnetic field, you have a phase transition between a commensurate lattice distortion to an incommensurate lattice distortion, and that means in a magnetic field, you can shift the position of the ions. That means this transition must driven by should be driven, there's pretty good evidence then, by an interaction between the ions and the spin, because the magnetic field couples primarily to the spin, and but with a magnetic field you can shift the position of the ions, so you think it's magnetoelastic interaction that drives the transition, and that you would call a spin piles transition, but that's not yet been measured, so this proof in this sense is not there, maybe it's not a spin piles transition. No, this has been seen in copper germanate, but not in sodium monodate.
So what magnetic field, if you just...
Well, yeah, that's the problem, could be. So in copper germanate, it should be about, it's about 12 Tesla, right? And the energy scale is about four times that high, so maybe 40, 50 Tesla. So that's a problem, but you could see this one a little bit. Yeah, so that's not against... You're right, that's not ruling that out completely.
Is there evidence
in the transition
temperature that
it's behaving
one dimensionally?
About the transition temperature that it's behaving? No, about this compound that's behaving.
Kind of indirect. What about the dispersion of them?
I'm coming to that. The magnons are really, this has been measured. The magnon dispersion has been measured. I will show that in the second part. It's pretty good. Two-dimensional, so the one-dimensionality is very small. I will show that.
So I guess you can predict the exact critical field just from the gap.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you know precisely where it should occur. So you're saying it's about 40?
I think something between 40 or 50, I guess. Because the gap is, the 2 delta over TC is larger than copper germanate, a factor of 2. So if you scale, so I think it's about... So the gap is 4 times higher, right? More or less exactly 4 times than this is in copper germanate. So the critical field should be exactly more or less 4 times higher. So 48 Tesla, more or less. Okay, there were some new developments, mostly last year. First of all, several groups, more or less at the same time, reconsidered the crystallographic structure, so experimentally, mostly and theoretically, and they all found that it should be centrosymmetric, so that the old result by Kalinkarpi was not really correct. So that means that you have only one vanadium site, all other ones are equivalent. But if you have only one equivalent vanadium site, then they must be in a mixed valence state. So the question is, how can that be? And that's why we did an LDA calculation, which I'm now going to present, and Horsch and Mack also came with the same results. Yeah, I will give a metal, yeah. But
you say that the gap is direct in LDA give a metal.
I will discuss that. It's very easy. I mean, my mechanic can just say the result. So what you find in LDA actually, because of splitting of two bands, that you find a more or less one-dimensional half-filled band. Of course, in LDA that's a metal, but if you have a one-dimensional half-filled band, it's a perfect nesting, then you have some U, which you didn't include in the LDA, you will get an insulator.
What does centrosymmetric mean?
Around
O1 side of centrosymmetric?
Yes, O1 side, yeah. No, O1 not, sorry, no. It's in between. The O1, as you see, if you do it O1, it's not central, it's in between, it is in between here, I think, yeah.
Centrosymmetric
with respect to which one? To this point, so this point. Which, because then, you put this one into this one, this one to 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 this one. Yeah. Okay, so we did LAA, so an LRPV, LRPW calculation. Actually, I didn't do it myself. It was Werner Weber and Holger Smolinski, which did the actual calculations. Actually, Holger Smolinski, and this is the result. So there are several things to be said. First of all, the oxygens are really filled. There's a -3 electron volt, so the ionic picture in this sense is pretty good. Oxygen filled. The sodium bands, I think, somewhere up here. They're also empty. So that's okay. And near the Fermi surface, there are only vanadium D bands, essentially. So of course, there's some mixing with oxygen bands, but essentially the character is vanadium D. So that's one thing. The second thing is dispersion perpendicular to the plane, so in Z direction, is very small. So it's really pretty good two-dimensional, one would say. Then dispersion along the chains, which I'll say is much larger than perpendicular to that. So if I put up this this one here again, so this is B, so this is a large dispersion, and here in this perpendicular direction, that is a small dispersion.
What about the third direction?
The Z. Z is this one. So practically no dispersion. Oh, sorry.
So B was
B was
the upper.
Yeah, B is this one, A and C. Yeah. So I think we can forget about Z. That's okay, I think, in this compound. So we have say that. So per formula unit, well, we'll say that several times, we have two chemical formulas per unit cell. That means there are four vanadium bands per unit cell. So four times five is something. And one finds that the lowest vanadium bands are dxy orbitals, and there are four of them, and they're splitted. One can make a symmetry analysis of these bands. So this is symmetry analysis of these bands. One finds that the symmetry is here even and odd with respect to the plane of symmetry through the O1. So I have these are the O1s. So these are bands which are even and odd with respect to this plane of symmetry. And we have two of them because we have two formula units per unit cell. And now we know that, of course, we have four vanadiums, so that means two electrons, but we have only two bands crossing the Fermi level. That means we have two half-filled bands at the Fermi level. And these two other ones are above. I'm going to come back to that later on. So, to understand that more, so I guess that's what I already said. So we have two bonding dxy orbitals which are half filled, and then the general rule is then if you include Hubbard U, you will get an insulator. So if you do a tight binding analysis to understand where the electrons are located in which state, one finds roughly the following. So these are these vanadiums, and these vanadiums here, the oxygens are here not included in this analysis. And one finds that the major hopping matrix element is along this line here. This is a rung of a ladder. And the second, so this is 0.37 electron volt, and the other one about 2.5 times smaller is along this ladder. So that means we have here, on average, one electron here per rung of this ladder, but these electrons are in a bonding state, and they form a one-dimensional Hubbard chain.
And one is the explanation why T2 is larger than T1?
Sorry, no. So these are, well, I'm going back to that one, these are very small. The surprising thing actually is why is it so small, because actually the distance here is larger. I'll go come back when if you want to, I can discuss it in some detail. This is just an artifact maybe of this fitting. I mean, the error of this fitting are much larger somehow than the magnitude of these of these constants.
You took just one orbital.
Well, yeah,
you
I will.
To fit those
yeah, I can show you fitting with more orbitals. We did that too. And it depends, of course, that. I mean, if a quantity is so small, then it just.
There is a reasonable systematic way of downfolding of leaving out demands away from the energy. And then you find that.
Yeah, no, Sascha Lichtenstein is advocating that one, yeah. Right?
The point is that what happens then is that these hopping intervals are no longer actually direct overlap between 2D, but they are constraints of oxygen orbitals in it and S orbital effects in it, and so they shouldn't be interpreted as they would be.
But I have two transparencies a little bit more. Okay, maybe. I put on first this one. So we have done the same with more orbitals. If we do that with more orbitals, it's just getting more complicated. So this is here the oxygen Y, the oxygen X orbital included. And you have all kind of parameters. And now this T1 and this T2 are a little bit different, of course, but still T2 is larger than T1. But as you see, this depends really directly on that. Then you want to have direct hopping here, T perp, indirect via the oxygen, etc., etc. But if you somehow downfold this model in the sense that you integrate out the oxygen, you come back to that one, essentially. And it's pretty complicated why these are so small. I mean, one of the key issues here were that these coupling between the letters are so small. I mean, that was not what we expected. I mean, somehow when doing the calculation, we more expected that this one to be larger than these ones because the distance is smaller. And it turned out that there's probably a series of factors why that is. One is that we have a nearly 90 degree exchange, so that makes it small. And the direct exchange is made small by the overlap, by the near cancellation of 2 and 3 center integrals.
So the more important is that the XY orbitals are planes, and those planes are not in phase. One atom on one level is above the plane, another level is below.
Yeah, that's.
So they look not in the
Yeah, so that's what you're saying, Dust. So this, they actually tilted. So these are here the vanadium sides. Here this O3. And where's the O1? These are the O1-2 plane. So they're looking towards the O1. And so this is. I have to show, tell you what I'm. No, actually, I put it here already on the side. So what I'm. The draw here is these are two orbitals here. And so between. Which should be pretty close to each other, but actually they're looking away from each other because this one is this one. And this one is this one. But they're actually looking towards this O1. So by this overlap is this, and this one is large. But this one is small.
And in one letter, they're on the same side.
Yeah.
Side.
Yeah.
So they directly look at each other.
Yeah. But that's, for example, something which is very difficult to predict from symmetry analysis.
Sure.
So I have to do.
It's the same story almost one day.
Okay, so thanks for that. Well, maybe somebody who didn't know that. So then we determined U. Well, so how did we determine U? Actually, I'm not sure how you do this. We first determined it wrongly, then maybe rightly. So we do the following. We dope onto the sodium. So we changed the formal the nuclear charge of vanadium, sodium. And what happens is the charge, since the sodium is so well above the Fermi level, the charge flows into the vanadium. So you can show dope in a fractional number of charge, and if you do that, so you find you take as an energy of reference the upper part of the oxygen band. So these are the oxygen bands, pretty here, really inert. And if you dope a little bit, then you find that the vanadium bands get shifted. And if you just do half refog, this shift is
Look here, the normal excitation would be between D sides. So the normal definition of U, when you transfer electron from one D side to another.
Exactly.
Side,
that's it.
But not from oxygen.
No, that's of course true. But you have to take a zero of energy to calculate that one.
But it would have been more natural to make the check resonation between D, on one D decrease and another D decrease. That would be more natural.
Yeah, but that's the question.
I understand what he said. I don't understand the word.
So
he would it be more natural for one?
No. The definition of U is that the range of transfer of one electron from one D side to another D side.
Depending how you define it. U is also defined as U and up and down on a D side. And if you just increase more the charge, no. It's a quarter.
No, look here. The normal definition of spectroscopy is the following: of d n plus one plus e d n minus one
minus two
e d n.
Yeah.
That's the definition of spectroscopy U.
Yeah, but that's a question also, but I'm not an expert, as you see, so much in LDA, but it's not so easy to do that in LDA.
Yeah, that's effective excitation from D to D. What you do is actually excitation from, I don't know, oxygen to D.
No, but we do a fractional.
All D is in the same time, you see?
No, that is a sort of a definition of it. Somebody wrote down the Hubble Hamiltonian U in it, and with no reference to that. I mean, you could calculate that, and sure enough, that's often is done.
I think that's the more basic, right? I mean, this is what you do in spectroscopy, we cannot do anything else, but I think that's the more basic definition. So that's what we do exactly, right? I mean, we just change the number of electrons. So actually, since we do it not spin polarized, they go half into
total charge. You see, you got total charge on D. You charge all D sides.
Yeah.
That will effectively give you not only the disease at all sides, but also effective increasing of Coulomb energy.
But there is no Coulomb account here. I mean, you're right about this.
I wonder if the answer depends on what purpose you want it for. You're probably going to estimate a J next, right? So maybe that's... Well, no, actually, we don't do anything with that, just was just a given estimate. But I just, since I knew that it would cause controversy, I thought I would put it up. It's not important for us, but...
okay, what number did you get?
Well, 2.8.
2.8, it's
But I'm open to
Is there an experimental measure of a charge gap
at
high temperatures?
What do you mean charge gaps? The infrared gap, for example.
Impressive.
Yeah, that's a quota, that's 0.6.
That was already experimental.
Yeah, that was 0.6. The key reason was here just that the U is larger than the Hopping matrix element which we have, or two or four times the Hopping matrix element. So somehow one is in a not very strong but pretty strongly correlated system. And of course, now to estimate the true band gap, that one maybe you will have to do with your kind of method. We just did a very rough calculation because we didn't do LDA plus U, we just did LDA and say, well, if you put in additional U, then we would have, so essentially what we will have, we have one electron per rung, and so these form then Hubbard chains, and if I do an charge transfer excitation, I put one electron from, so maybe you should, as you say that here, we put here one electron from one rung to another one, then I have an empty one and then doubly occupied one, and I calculate the energy difference, and U doesn't matter actually here, and it comes out more or less order of magnitude is correct with respect to experiment, but it's just an order of magnitude, well, it's rough estimate here.
Why don't you get the U term?
Because this is quarter filled, right? So I can put two electrons per rung.
Yeah.
Also, I can take U to infinity and still have the same one here. So a finite U would just give me then that the singlet state has a finite energy. Okay, so that's the picture. So the picture we have, maybe I should draw it again, because that's what I'm now going to use, is that we have a system where we have a magnetic moment, but this magnetic moment is not located on an iron, but on a vanadium oxygen vanadium bond. And these magnetic moments have then, of course, an interaction with each other, and they form a one-dimensional Heisenberg model. Right. So, but of course there's some charge degree of freedom still. I mean, in the high temperature phase, the magnetic moment has equal probability being here and there. But it's conceivable, and actually that's what's going to happen, and then in the low temperature phase, the electron will have a higher probability between here and there, so there will be spontaneous breaking of the symmetry. And there will be several consequences of that. And in order to make to link to experiments, we wanted to do some calculation of what happens to the magnetic excitation if that happens. So first there's one observation, namely that the exchange integral, so the J in the high temperature phase, so which you get from fitting the susceptibility to the one-dimensional Heisenberg model, is substantially larger than the J which you find in the low temperature phase, for example, by fitting it to the Newton scattering data, also to the fall down of the susceptibility. So the J is actually, in this sense, temperature dependent. It's different below and above the transition temperature. So it's clearly that this kind of charge ordering what will occur will also occur, will influence the exchange integrals.
Does that sound like 20%? Different. So
it is.
I would have thought that there's a lot of sort of quasi 1D systems where you did neutron scattering, you get 1J, and then.
That's very large, 20%. I mean, in the spin piles compound, it's a 1% difference.
No, that depends on what fit you use for the susceptibility. I mean, and with how much frustration it's only. I mean, for spin copper germanate, there's values that would differ by 50% floating around.
50%, not the overall J, the J1, J2, fit, but
no,
not the overall.
The J1, the
yeah, but the overall J doesn't change very much. But also 50% seems to be very large anyhow, but 10% maybe.
20%
difference. What about the moment? And is the moment,
the
saturation moment at zero temperature, and that moment that you see in the susceptibility at high temperature, are they the same?
So how do you measure the saturation moment?
Curie law.
Yeah, the Curie law, I know, but at zero temperature?
Just measure the total magnetization divided by the number of sides.
It's not magnetic, the system. It's not magnetic. It's the current state is paramagnetic. It's not there's no long range order.
Okay.
There's a gap to spin excitation. There's no long range order. I forgot to say that.
Okay.
Do you understand why the J is lower below the?
Yeah, I want to say that. Yeah, I think we understand that, but maybe other people don't agree. Yeah.
I think your NDA team is also trying to make this case about off-diagonal Coulomb matrix elements.
No.
VIJs.
No. How would you do that?
I mean, of the Coulomb, it's possible to just make a larger supercell under different constraints, and then you have
Okay. No, didn't do that, no. That is, of course, very important because some people think that it's the Coulomb interaction, the inter-site Coulomb interaction, which drives this charge ordering. So if there's a repulsion here, that in the low temperature phase you would like to have less charge here than there. That might be, but it's not clear. So at the moment I think it's completely open question which are the forces, whether it's more spin lattice interaction or Coulomb interaction which drives this transition.
Question?
Yeah.
Does one know whether the magnitude of the charge gap changes at the position?
No. I think I didn't see any measurements.
So the 0.6 dB is
probably known, but I don't. Well, I would find it difficult because this 0.6 dB is pretty, I mean, it's not, I mean, it's, it goes up pretty, I mean, it's not so sharp, the edge, but, I mean, 0.6 dB with respect to a 10 millielectron volt or maybe something like that.
Conductivity below TSV?
So, sorry, what?
Are the conductivity data below the transition
temperature? I'm not sure, but it's very good insulator already at high temperature. It's a very good insulator.
So in that doesn't work. It was a transition even for the temperature.
Sorry?
It doesn't become metallic.
No. I think some mega ohm per square. It's a very good insulator. So that I think it's not measurable, I think.
So even on the temperature where there is no change ordering, it is still good insulator.
Very good, yeah. Well, very good from the respect to the conductivity. Because, I mean, if you have a true gap of 0.6, I mean, yeah.
How could you explain that if there is totally no order at all to have temperatures lying in the metallic?
Yeah, that's what I said. It's a one-dimensional, as I said, essentially you have a one-dimensional Hubbard. So because you have only the bonding states, which are filled, and the anti-bonding states are higher in energy, you have the bonding states form a one-dimensional Hubbard chain, and that one is then half-filled. If you have a half-filled Hubbard chain in the bonding orbitals, then that's, you have a Mott Hubbard insulator. So that's our picture.
With those pictures,
yeah, okay.
Both bands to get
charged. Exactly, yeah, yeah. And so that's why, yeah, of course, you need both bands. And so what is the, therefore I'm saying the energetics of what drives it is not clear. I mean, there's substantial lattice distortion. So again, or loose, depending on what you do, lattice energy, and there's a substantial Coulomb energies involved. I'm not going to discuss that because we didn't do a theory, and yeah. So we want to just to do the following. We know there will be some charge ordering in this low temperature compound because there have been measurement moves R indicating that. And we were, on our point of view was just to say, well, if you have some charge ordering, can we draw some conclusions? So we don't ask you the question, which are the energies driving that? We just take the experimental facts there. There is some charge ordering. And so our question was, which are the consequences on the magnetic interactions? And there are, of course, different kind of charge ordering possible. Here we'll discuss essentially two kinds, namely in line, so where we have here all vanadium plus 5 and plus 4, all zigzag charge ordering. So we call DC, delta C, the charge order parameter, so the charge density would be 1 plus minus delta C half on each ion. And now we want to explore the consequences on magnetic exchange. So the magnetic exchange actually is pretty complicated to calculate between two rungs because one has several excited states, and here we just do the most simplest considerations. It comes just saying, let's say if you have magnetic exchange between two sides, you can have only interchange if you have electrons on these sides. So you would say, first approximation, the magnetic exchange is proportional to the charge densities at these two sides. But now we don't have an electron on one side, but have actually electrons on the rung. Yeah. So we have not exchange between sides, but between have electron between the magnetic moment on the rung. So we have add. You have to add the magnetic exchange between these two sides here. And now, if we have zigzag ordering here, then that has the following formula if you put that in. So this one is smaller, this one is more charge, and we have this formula. So if you have zigzag ordering, we find that the magnetic exchange decreases with, if you have charge ordering. If you would have inline charge ordering, you would have this formula. We would have here both increased and both decreased. We would actually have an increase in the magnetic exchange with charge order. So J infinite is here the magnetic exchange without charge order. So that we say, well, that was the question. Can we understand why the magnetic exchange integral decreases? We say, yes, we can understand that if there's charge ordering, it should decrease. And since the increase is roughly 20%, so this charge order parameter squared should be roughly 0.2, so delta C is 0.5 more or less. Now, Newton scattering, also dispersion between two ladders, has been measured. So the question is now, what happens to the intermagnetic exchange between two ladders? So we have actually here the kind of trellis ladder structure, so where we have one ladder which is shifted by half a unit with respect to the nearest neighboring ladders. Now, of course, this is frustrated at high temperature. That means at high temperature, when all these ions are equivalent, then there's a perfect magnetic frustration with respect to the propagation of magnons perpendicular to the ladders in a direction. And now, our point was to say, well, if you have this kind of zigzag charge ordering, this frustration would be lifted. Why would that frustration be lifted? Because we have then three kind of interside exchange between ladders, namely one with between two sides with more charge, one between two sides with less charge, and two actually between two sides with different charge. So, and the effective frustration is measured then by two taper minus j prime minus j double prime, and if you add that up, you find this one is proportional to the charge order parameter squared. And that means you would think that you have only dispersion perpendicular to the ladder if you have charge ordering. That's okay, in agreement with experiment, and you can make that more concrete by doing some bond operator theory. Of course, we did this theory before the crystallographic structure of the low temperature phase was known, so we did some guessing, how the, which turned out to be probably wrong, of this, how the dimer, of some dimerization, how they would be placed in the system. But I guess nevertheless the results are more or less okay. So what we assume here, we have one electron per rung with some charge ordering. And since we have a gap of 10 millielectron volt, we need to have some kind of dimerization of these one-dimensional ladders. And here. And so the next one can be dimerized like that, this one is dimerized like that, or the other way around. And so we have a larger unit cell, which this is also a rhombic unit cell. In the low temperature phase, this unit cell doubles, and so that's okay. This is a high temperature unit cell, and that's doubled in the low temperature phase, so that's okay. And one can actually do the calculation in a primitive unit cell, but that's more a technical issue here. So then we just did a simple bond operator theory to get an estimate. So you have singlets and a basis of singlets and triplets on every dimer, because you have an electron here, an electron here, so you have spin singlets and triplets. This is constraint, which you actually do only mean field theory, that this is one. So we use a linear Holzhausen Primakov approximation, which I learned from Wolfram Brenich, and we can calculate the magnon dispersion. That's all not very complicated, and maybe I'll just show you the results. The magnet dispersion has this form, and epsilon of k depends on this j double prime and j, and so on. And so, then we fit to experiment. So what actually did we fit? This parameter we had from the high, this is the j in the high temperature phase, that was fit to the susceptibility data. This one we had from experiment also, from the low temperature phase, the j. The delta C chart was fitted because of the differences, and so we have two parameters which are left, namely the dimerization delta, so there's a J1 is 1 plus delta and J2 is 1 minus delta, and the coupling between the ladders at high temperature, and that turns out to be very small. And if you do that, we get pretty good agreement between theory and experiment. So that is Newton scattering.
Excuse me, a bit too fast. So which dimerization pattern are you assuming occurs? Is this what occurs in a single zigzag ladder?
Yeah, that's the dimerization pattern in a single zigzag ladder. So that's the Here I have let's say this. Yeah, I see it stated here, sorry. So this is a large J, small j, large j, so J1.
The zigzag ladder, in fact, which is equivalent to this, J1, J2.
Yeah.
And the memorization, we believe, is just like...
Yeah, like in copper germinate. So our argument was here...
The memorization would be in the diagonal ones.
No, the
diagonal. That's
different. No, well, this is not 100%. This, you mean like this?
No. If you had a single J1, J2, just had two ladders.
Yes.
Suppose your system just consisted of two of these chains. Then the diagonalization will be...
Yeah, one ladder with two.
Yeah.
One zigzag ladder.
Yeah, but I draw that because there's one... I mean, I draw that because there's one electron per rung, so there's one exchange.
No. Suppose you just had two lines like that.
Yeah, like here, yeah.
No, that's one line.
You mean two
of them.
Yeah, okay. Yeah?
Right. If you had... Then the diagonalization
will
be along the diagonal.
Which
diagonal?
Here?
Yes.
Well, you could assume that, but that's not true because the J is so small, you can never... So that's the main one of the main point here. The J between...
So that's what happens if you had only two chains, even if J' was very small.
We would have to investigate this numerically.
Yeah, well, you can... Well, depending...
It's obvious in the limit where it's just like a single chain with a small computer couple.
Yeah, but you see the J here is about 50 times smaller than the other one. You might then say, so you cannot really say that this is taking this as a reference state. Maybe, of course, you can say this for two letters there will be substantial. A singlet pairing between these diagonal bonds, but not you cannot take it as a basis. For example,
no,
in
no,
a bond operator
symmetry. I would say which symmetry is broken, and there's one phase where the symmetry breaking pattern corresponds to dimers on the diagonal bonds. That's not to say that you know in the limit where
isn't that the zigzag charge case?
Maybe we're talking about different things here.
Yeah, I don't know.
What I'm saying is that we have a single zigzag ladder, and we don't fool around with the charge.
I think it's zigzag ladder, not two.
The dimerization pattern is always on the corresponding to being on the diagonal bond.
Of course, if you have a single zigzag ladder, yeah, that's chain, that's okay. Yeah, nobody. That's okay, but we don't. Yeah, but we don't have that. Yeah.
So I'm trying to understand why you get a different pattern here. Because of what charge effects, or because of inner?
I mean,
coupling?
The J here is 500 Kelvin, and this J is 10 Kelvin. So without charge effects.
You're saying inter-ladder coupling is changing the symmetry breaking pattern that you get for a single ladder?
No, this is... Well, I don't understand.
What's the dimerization just focused on a single two-leg ladder? I don't know.
Yeah, the dimerization is that these two move to... Well, let's say these two move together. This moon... as I said, this move... So you have an electron here and an electron here, and they move together. An electron here, an electron here, and they move together.
Ions.
Sorry?
Electrons or ions.
Electrons. Well, and the ions also, of course.
A lot. Periodic lattice distortion.
Yeah. Yeah. So we assumed here...
No, I know, but that's different than the...
Then what?
When you have the charge ordering, and that seems like an extra symmetry.
So that's an extra symmetry, exactly, yeah. Yeah, but that's... But in, I mean, in as I showed you at the beginning, there is this crystallographic doubling of the unit cell. The unit cell doubles along the B. That's fact. So there are several things happening. The unit cell doubles, so this is kind of this symmetry. That happens. That has been measured. That's the same as in copper germinate.
So along B, but not along A.
Along A doubles also, and along C it four times.
Along A?
Two times also, unit cell.
Would one expect the transition to happen at the same time?
That's a different issue now. Nobody knows what kind of transition, I mean, what. That's why there's confusion. Nobody exactly knows what drives what, whether it's the Coulombian action or whether the crystallographic elastic energies.
But isn't it, I mean, I think Raju's question is important, isn't it? Surprising it seems that
the two symmetries are both being broken at the same
time. Well, there are experimental claims which say there's a tiny difference of 0.4 Kelvin, we have two phase transitions, but not everybody has seen that. Only one group has seen that.
This is in X-ray scattering or something?
That was in the lattice Ossinus coefficient.
In
thermal expansion coefficients. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So they claim that the two transition temperatures.
Yeah.
And which they then assign to these two.
Yeah, I was difficult. I mean, there are different claims of how do you assign that. Yeah.
And we're also going to discuss the scenario which has been tested. Yeah. The second letter.
Yeah. I wanted to do that now. Yeah. So.
That's Jarbo. He's going to discuss.
Yeah. So that is actually. So it was a very. I mean, from this scenario here, included everything we knew about experiments. The symmetry. Breaking along B and the spin gap. So the main issue here is the following. The spin gap is 10 millielectron volt. And you want to explain a thin spin gap of 10 millielectron volt by saying, well, this is an important interaction, but this interaction is only one millielectron volt, you have a hard time. So that was our issue. Well, that's what we're saying, that the dimerization along the ladders seems to be important for that. And actually, so what turned out, there's pretty good agreement. Actually, we have also a prediction here, and that has been, they redid the neutron scattering experiment and found very good agreement with our prediction for the over the overall shape of the dispersion.
This is the spin wave dispersion.
So, but actually, as I said, we did this theory before actually the crystallographic structure was known in the low temperature phase, and there have been two groups this year measuring or claiming to have measured. Yeah.
One question before we go over this scenario.
Yeah.
Did you see what happens to the bands when you did this dimerization?
No, we didn't do LDA in the low temperature phase.
You had the tight binding, no?
That's true, but...
It would have been very easy to do the supercell and see if you had a splitting of the bands or something. I mean, an LDA would be very costly, but the tight binding would have been very cheap. You had all the elements in.
Yeah, but you, as Wolfram Penny was saying, you would to calculate the energy to minimize actually, or to see what?
No, to see the splitting of bands.
The splitting. Yeah, no, we didn't do that. No. Yeah. But then you also need to estimate how they depend on the distance, etc.
You're hopping
to do. Oh, you just do it.
Would have done that, but okay.
Yeah. It's better for the rules.
Yeah. One could have done that, yeah.
When people do LDA and they dimerize totally different. I mean, there are some calculations.
Well, our problem was that the student disappeared to industry, so...
the triplet space, you see really a sharp mode and there's almost no weight in the continuum, or is there some continuum?
Which continuum?
Is there a continuum? The question is, do neutrons see the continuum?
Well, there might be continuum, but yet... You see, it's pretty high in energy. The dispersion goes up to 40 millielectron volt.
It's really a sharp moment.
Yeah, I'm not sure whether higher up there is a continuum, or whether they look for it. That I don't know yet. It should be higher up, yeah.
So the beta is just these points, or is there constant?
No, there are scans. There are scans, more scans. So they also made up to 40 or 50 millielectron volts.
Up to 50.
Yeah. But I saw it only, I don't have a preprint, I saw it only on the conference, so I don't, cannot show it to you. But there's sharp peaks, I mean, there's really no, it's really very nice spin gap, so that's why there's well-defined magnons. But it's not, it's in paramagnetic state, right? It's not in an ordered state. So it's pretty difficult to do the Newton scattering analysis at low temperature because, let's see, how many atoms we have. We have, sodium, vanadium, 2O5. These are 8 atoms. In the chemical unit cell, we have double, so 16. And in the low temperature phase, we have times 2, times 2, times 4, times 16. So we have 16 squared, which is something... 256. Okay, yeah, that's not so difficult, yeah. 256 atoms in the unit cell, and it's still somewhat controversial. So what happens, or seems to happen, is the following. So what happens is, here we have this zigzag ladder, here, zigzag chain, here we have the ladder with the O1 here in between. These are the sodium sites. Can one see anything from this one here? Yes, one can see the following. These are the vanadium side here. It moves very little, so the arrow indicates how much they move. So by a factor of, I think they multiplied by a factor of 40 or so, but they're on scale. And here one sees that this sodium side moves pretty strongly. This, No, that's the sodium. That is the oxygen here. These are the oxygen. Vanadium. These vanadiums moved dramatically, but this vanadium doesn't move. Moves. So they find essentially three different vanadiums. Let's see, which is here the best picture. They didn't. I think don't like these pictures too much. Okay, maybe this lower one. This is. So they think. So this was one of the ladders. You come looking at the high temperature phase, and this is another ladder. And the idea is that these two ladders become inequivalent. But this is a ladder where the charge is more or less the same. So this is still a quarter filled. In sense, this is vanadium plus 4, 5, so a mixed valence, so half an electron, half an electron, half an electron. Here's one missing. No, sorry, that's the other way around. I'm sorry. This is not moving, practically not moving. So this is half an electron, half an electron, half an electron, half an electron, and these ones are strongly moving, so I have here one electron essentially, zero electron, one electron, zero electron, one electron. So you have two kind of ladders. So one, which is as before in the high temperature phase, and the other one, where you have zigzag charge ordering. And the next one is again like in the high temperature phase. This one actually, which is in the high temperature phase, is dimerized, because we have here, here, and here. So that one, which is in the high temperature phase, has a dimerization in the sense that this one is moving up, this one down, down, up, etc. And this one, I think the same or the other way around, the other way around. So that's why the unit cell, etc. So here the electron is in a bonding orbital, and here there's a charge offering.
This is another symmetry breaking?
What do you mean, another?
Ladders were equivalent to the
beginning. Other symmetries are broken, but the unit cell, of course, is just also twice. Before we just didn't know which was the doubling of the unit cell. That's of course the same. But which crystallographic symmetries are broken internal, that's different, of course.
This is another proposal.
No, that is experiment now. That is X-ray.
Supposed to guess. The
previous one was fitted to 9 months.
Yeah. Okay, so that's, I say proposal because some other ex-crystallographers which I talked to are not convinced about that.
And there is also...
But otherwise it's experiment.
NMR, which is
really... Yeah, there's NMR data, several NMR data. So this one will predict three different vanadiums. It's half an electron, 1 and 0 electron, d electron. And NMR says there's only two vanadium sides. So it seems to be in contradiction with NMR data. But, in this sense, also, apart from that, it's, I believe, also in disagreement with the fact that we have a spin gap, but, so everybody, so what these, some of these also proposed was the following. I can tell you this scenario. They proposed that the following is happening. Okay, so this one is moving to this direction, this one is moving to this. The next one is here, it's moving to this direction. This direction. So they propose that you have the following structure. You have six vanadium sides with four electrons. 1, 2, 3, 4. And that these six vanadium sides form, because it's a finite lattice, right? A finite lattice with a finite number of electrons, have a spin gap. And they propose that this is a spin gap which you see in experiment. But as I said, we don't believe in that because we think this J is much too small. But this is without any calculation, that is what the crystallographic group proposes, that you have these clusters. And so I think there's plenty of surprises. It might be like that, but I think it's still an open question. So let me come to the conclusions. So I think what is pretty clear for nowadays, it's a quarter-filled ladder compound, so it's pretty interesting. So quite a few groups now try to dope that. For example, you can make natrium, sodium deficient, or you can try to do some calcium in it to get more electrons, and the hope would, of course, also to get something conducting, but that's at the moment not yet been succeeded. It's difficult in the vanadates, but one can dope it to the sodium deficiency, that's no problem. So below tin spy, this transition temperature, which might be 2 or 1 transition temperature, we surely have a kind of dimerization, or maybe larger clusters. Maybe we don't have only clusters of 2 electrons, maybe we have clusters of more electrons, but surely also some kind of zigzag charge ordering. Actually, the zigzag charge ordering has also been seen in resonant X-ray by Fuji. So he's to do resonant X-ray to see the difference between vanadium plus 5 and plus 4, and he sees evidence for zigzag charge ordering. So as I just discussed now, the new crystallographic determination of the low temperature phase gives indication that you have both zigzag charge ordering and uniform charge. So, thank you very much.
Could you comment once again on why you believe that the off-diagonal Coulomb interactions are, or why you excluded off-diagonal?
No, I didn't include. I didn't exclude them all. I just didn't calculate them.
This is open.
It's open, yeah, how large they are. I mean, you can do the usual estimates by saying, putting a charge here and there.
So you might want, you would also go along with the model that, that includes off the charge ordering, Coulomb interactions to drive the charge ordering.
Yeah,
Shortly would change the pattern, the charge ordering pattern.
Why then? What kind of pattern would you?
Well, the way that the charges, the plus and minus of the range of charge.
I mean,
depending on where the...
you wouldn't get a uniform phase in between. And most of our Inkomsky did that. And of course, you get a charge ordering, like a zigzag or so. But, I mean, you have difficulties, as most of what you're saying, explaining, the magnitude of the spin gap is that. I mean, the magnitude of the transition temperature, because your Coulomb interactions are, of course, of half an electron volt or an electron volt. And why do you get now a transition temperature of 30 Kelvin, that's how much electron volt that's, that is 3 or 4 millielectron volts, that's very difficult, I mean, to explain. Just from a purely electronic model. So it seems to me more likely that you should include electrons, phonon, magneto-elastic interactions. So purely electronic model is difficult, I think.
But the breaking of the symmetry along the X and Y direction is completely independent?
Which breaking of which symmetry?
This proposal, you break the symmetry along the x-axis. You said there's a doubling of unit cell in both.
Yeah. So for us, for our proposal, it was not important, because. But of course, for this new X-ray determination, that's of course very important. I mean, you can do that anyhow. So what? I mean, the idea is the following. I mean, you have two ladders in the high-temperature chemical unit cell, so that you have enough phonons in the high-temperature phase to drive a transition which makes them inequivalent, these two ladders. Of course, if you would have only one ladder in the chemical unit cell, it would be difficult to think about phonons making two different ladders in this sense. So breaking additional symmetry, but here that's possible. So of course, in principle, that is very possible that this one occurs. So it's a subgroup of the high temperature phase.
Is the pattern in the C direction
feral,
or does it?
Let me see. Yeah, one knows, of course. I'm not sure whether I know. Let me see. So in C direction they are stacked like that. They're stacked like that. So this one, the next plane is like this one. So this fits into it. And I think there are four possibilities. You have this one can be here or here, and it can be here and here. That's why you have times four. So what you have one layer is where these two ladders are exchanged. And then you have the possibility of a half a shift. So that's why you have four times. I don't know which sequence it has, but that's why you have four times the lattice constant.
What is the status on isostructural substitution?
Well, when does sodium deficient is no problem, because that's then your spin pulse temperature goes down. And impurities, everything becomes more washed out.
Sorry?
No, not metallic, no. And calcium substitution is in principle possible, but somehow technically difficult, because calcium monadate has a... No, calcium. On the sodium. Because calcium monadate has much higher melting points than sodium monadate, so that's somehow it's difficult to mix them.
Wasn't this alpha prime phase unstable in one direction at about have additional sodium or what efficiency?
Well, the alpha prime, well, originally it was an alpha prime phase because they were saying it was non-centrosymmetric. But in a certain sense, this alpha prime phase disappeared.
I see, it's not anymore.
Because it's,
How much efficiency of sodium could you get before it becomes metallic?
I don't know, I just saw experiments, maybe 5% or so. Then T-spin pipes goes more or less to zero. I don't know about experiment. I mean, you can do it more or less all the way down. I'm not sure whether you have an intermediate metallic phase. Probably you have, I don't know. Because if you take it out completely, of course you... But somewhere in between you must have a metallic phase. Yeah, I agree.
You said sometime in your talk that this is not a
spin pulse
material.
Well, because there's all kind of, a pure spin pulse material, you wouldn't have all this charge ordering and confusing stuff occurring.
Oh, so just for that reason?
Yeah.
It's awesome. A complicated pulse.
And also, of course, in a pure spin pulse material, you would know just the spin orbit coupling, a spin phonon coupling, which drives the transition. And that is not clear whether that is the case here, actually. Probably not, because you have also charge ordering. I mean, it might have something to do with this. I mean, you must see, you lose a lot of magnetic energy. I mean, the J decreases by 20%, which you think is small, which I think is large, because it's a uniform J. It's not J1, J2. So So that you get, you lose a lot of magnetic energy per unit cell, which you don't do in spin pies. There you gain energy. So here you lose magnetic energy, a substantial amount. And then sometimes I'm estimated that it's more or less the condensation energy. Roughly it's the same amount of the condensation energy you lose in magnetic exchange energy. Yeah.
So you lose magnetic exchange energy, you lose the elastic energy. The only gaining is the side ordering.
Maybe, yeah. Yeah. Probably. Yeah. Yeah. That's probably it, yeah.
Is the gap ratio comparable to copper germanium or is it larger?
Sorry,
the gap ratio.
No, it's 6 instead of 3.5.
A factor of 2 larger, which is also.
Yeah. But actually, if you do the numbers in a pure spin piles compound, it should be actually 6.
It's very different.
Yeah. But, yeah. So, yeah, good. Thank you.